NBC News Radio, I'm Tom Graham. A top advisor to Mitt Romney says the Republican presidential candidate would respect an Israeli decision to make a unilateral military strike against Iran, blunting Tehran's nuclear program. NBC's Peter Alexander is with the Republican in Israel.
The intention for Romney on this trip is to demonstrate he would effectively be a better friend to Israel than the current administration.
Romney received a warm welcome today from Israel's prime minister. Doctors in Uganda have confirmed that it is Ebola virus that has killed 14 people. Officials are urging Ugandans to be calm. Michael Phelps is off to a shaky start at this year's Olympics. Ryan Lochte stole the show in the first head-to-head showdown, although the two may become teammates.
There's a chance that the 100-meter freestyle relay will include both Ryan Lochte and Michael Phelps.
That's NBC's Stephanie Gosk reporting from London. This is NBC News Radio. A woman who was critically wounded in the Colorado theater shooting that left dead her six-year-old daughter has suffered a miscarriage. The woman's family said in a statement she recovered from surgery, but the trauma caused the miscarriage. Some people have found a new way to green up their dried-out lawns.
With two-thirds of the nation hit by a record drought stretching from coast to coast, more and more folks have reportedly been getting crafty about making their lawns look green again. Just like changing hair color, some people have decided to dye their grass green. Particularly if there's a dollar sign involved, people either selling a property, renting it, or for those with a business to run, many are trying out the green-colored biodegradable dyes that are available either from home improvement outlets or from a lawn service company.
That's NBC News Radio Scott Carr reporting. U.S. Representative David Camp, a Michigan Republican who chairs the Ways and Means Committee, says he will undergo treatment for a curable type of lymphoma. I'm Tom Graham, NBC News. Radio.
Guys, you've heard about Ageless Male, the natural supplement that helps boost testosterone levels within normal, healthy ranges. New and improved Ageless Male can help you feel more like you used to in your active life and in your romantic life. Now is the time to try Ageless Male because it's available risk-free. Just call 1-800-478-4616, 1-800-478-4616, 1-800-478-4616.
One thing I've learned on my journey to help save people money on car insurance is that folks across the country like convenience. And what could be more convenient than visiting Geico.com? We can manage your policy, pay your bill online, just about anything you need. And it's open 24/7. It's kind of like popping into the ultimate convenience store, except we save people money. And we don't have beef jerky.
For a free rate quote, visit Geico.com to see how much you could save. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Hi, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show. Tune in next Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 and 820 a.m. to hear the latest from the food and wine scene. We've got celebrity chefs, sommeliers, winemakers, and more all here to tell you about the inside skinny that you won't find anywhere else. That's Foodie and the Beast this Sunday at 11.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
I love my husband. But I didn't realize our difficulties had to do with his drinking. Our pastor suggested I go to Al-Anon family groups. I didn't think I would be comfortable, but I decided to try a meeting. The Al-Anon meeting really opened my eyes. Are you troubled by someone's drinking? You might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon family group meeting from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-Al-Anon.
It's about smiles. It's about laughter. It's about going out and making a difference in the life of a child. You don't have to get mad. You just have to go mad. GoMad2011.com is a website dedicated to supporting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. At GoMad, our mission is simple, to go out and make a difference. So how can you help? Visit the Wish Wall on GoMad2011.com and make a contribution today. Or find out how you can donate with a simple text message. Do it now so that we can continue to touch the lives of children with life-threatening conditions by granting their wishes.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Chris Stahl, who's the president of a company named G4I Development Group, Inc., Chris Archer, the president of Radius Technology Group, and Kelly O'Brien, the co-founder and CEO of Germain Systems. First up is a young man by the name of Chris Stahl, who's the president of G4I Development Group, Inc. What is G4I Development Group, Inc., Chris?
Well, G4I, in its present state, is a private equity placement firm for firms that are looking for outsourced business development.
Okay, that sounds like two things. Break it apart for us. What exactly?
Okay, we predominantly deal in the federal government sector. So these are companies that are looking for growth with the federal government in services or products alike. The problem that exists in that space is that with the SBA and MBDA and other organizations like that who do provide funding, banks traditionally do not lend to young, emerging small businesses. So the business development suffers. And so as a private equity firm, we look for firms that are generally under $30 million. And we provide all of the finance and expertise that's needed to bring the business into the facility so they can operate.
So not only do you provide capital, but you provide business development expertise?
Yeah, from our background, more than 20 years and more than $6 billion in awarded contracts, we've been able to figure out that the competency of people in this space, the processes, the technology, and the alliance partners that you have to succeed becomes the stumbling block for most small businesses. It's a very complicated space with an abyss of different ways that the government buys, different timelines, different costs.
Right.
And you really need somebody to navigate you through that, and that's exactly what we do.
How do you do that in one of your clients' office? Do you put a person on site or just provide expertise?
Well, on-site is key. We do a full examination of their business and their market space. Once we come through that examination and we identify that there is certainly a tremendous amount of spending in the government into that space, what their top customers are, we then align ourselves with their company. But the business development remains in our facility. We train the executives, senior vice presidents, proposal managers, business developers, capture managers, all the people that are needed to be able to do this process. We put the continuity of the income that will be needed to afford those people for 5 years, and we generally build companies 10x in that period of time.
Yeah. Where did you get all this expertise?
Only one way, the School of Hard Knocks. I started more than 20 years ago as a business developer in the consulting field and worked with many companies, and through that developed a tremendous understanding for what it takes to be successful.
How old is the company today?
5 years old.
5 years old, and how big or small are you guys?
Well, we run about a $25 million portfolio right now. That could translate into one of our companies, GPA HRSA, right now. In the last 6 months, has submitted a little over $1.5 billion.
Wow.
Worth of bids. With a relatively small budget, you can create big things, and that's what we're all about. So
you have a background in business development?
Yes.
How did that get started?
Well, I was always a business developer from...
Since you were 5 years old?
No. Growing up in a family that ran a business. business was always, you know, the topic of conversation around the table, around the house. You worked summers, you know, at the plant, and we were in Silicon Valley at the time in San Jose, and you know what the boom was. So I grew up in a very boom era from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But during the 70s through the 80s, and then, of course, I came out here in the mid-80s. But through that period of time, I saw the explosion in expertise and what happens when you have that kind of explosion. So we had kind of a mom-and-pop company that the big boys all moved in, you know, the Costco's and the, you know, the big Staples and all the big boys. So the mom-and-pops kind of got ran out. And I watched that whole thing go down in the process.
What did you learn from that experience?
Well, you have to recognize, you know, certainly have a vision for what the future has in store. And you have to know how to play your cards right. So you have to come up with a plan to either compete or get out timely.
So you could have gone in a lot of directions coming from Silicon Valley. You could have gone on the tech side, but you went on the business development side. Why that direction as opposed to the other?
I had a an innate desire to make money. So it was bothering me. I wanted things, you know. So you know, I immediately knew that this was what was going to happen in the Silicon Valley, what was going to happen for my family's business. There was a sheriff in town, and you didn't buck him, so I decided to head off for greener pastures. And that was hard. It was really hard because we had a very, my father and I had a very tight bond, and I was the top salesperson in his company at the time. And so it was very hard for me, but I could just see the decline. I knew it was going to happen, and I couldn't get that across to him. And so while he wrote it down, I moved to Florida. And Florida, I answered an ad and became the business developer for a government contracting firm. Now, this was back in the early 80s, about 83, and worked for a guy that built ammunition during Vietnam, 20-millimeter and 40-millimeter ammunition. And he did that in Quonset huts. And he made a very successful business out of that. But his mother got sick, and he didn't want to go back into the manufacturing business. So we started consulting at a time when Northrop Grumman and Lockheed and companies like that, they didn't outsource business development. I mean, that was a war room activity. It was down in the bowels of the company, and it was very proprietary. So we were very cutting edge. I knew that. And we got an opportunity. I got an education from those companies. They flew me all over the world to do all kinds of projects. And you get taught from the best of the best. I thought I was really smart. I was just a different color of money.
Talk about the biggest lesson that you learned hanging around those smart guys.
Well, it's kind of humbling when you go in as a consultant and you're basically sweeping up after them. I mean, you're looking at programs, dismantlement of Minuteman II missiles, retrofitting the Hubble telescope to SOFIA, which is a 747, taking infrared astronomy. These are really, really bright scientists. I also learned that not one person does this. It's a whole cadre of shakes, handshakes that go on in that process. And so I got a chance to experience all of those and to understand what it takes to be successful.
Chris, you have gone into, you call it private equity, but it's commercial as opposed to venture capital. Explain how that works and why you're doing it that way.
Yes, thank you for the clarity. It is commercial. And the reason why we went into that is because private investors and the VC, having built two companies prior to this, a company called ePipeline, which was a VC-backed company, very successful, and another company called Synchris, which built Privia, which is a product today that Boeing and Lockheed and Mantech and others use to manage their pipeline and proposal process. Being the founder and creator of those products, it gave me an understanding of what was really going to be needed in a way to capitalize and build and do those things. Having gone the VC route inside those firms, they took a big pound of my flesh. And after going through the process, I realized that I was going to have very little ownership and very little control over the companies. And in my first company, ePipeline, I lost control. And once I lost control, you lose the war and you're out. And it's very hard when you're, you know, they've got an attitude inside there that you're going to get a great learning and be paid very little.
But the banks, in exchange for a loss of control, what do they get?
Well, we take a position with these firms, first of all, a little bit differently. We're not really looking to make a public play. I mean, it could happen. But we really are looking for a defined subset of firms that so let me give you an example. I'm an exact person. We had a gentleman that visited us the other day in our healthcare industry, and 63 years old. He had made the determination that his sons, he had two sons that could take over the company. He was a former colonel out of the Army, and made the determination his sons were not going to be interested in the business. So now what does he do? He's got about another 5 or 10 years that he wants to put into this. His company's doing about $7 or $8 million. And he wants to retire comfortably. $7 or $8 million is not going to get you there.
Right.
So if we can get the company up to $40-50 million or whatnot, that's going to give him, you know, 4 to 5, maybe 6 times EBITDA, and it puts together a very good package where we'll take an investment inside his firm. We'll provide all the capitalization because at his age and where he's at, he's risk adverse. Our capital comes with the same interest rate that we borrow it at. We don't plus it up at all. We don't have
so
ratchets.
The bank's making a bet on you, not the company that you're investing
that
in.
That is correct, and that is the single big difference. When we looked at ourselves going to SBA and other firms and trying to get a loan, we're still subject to the same banking rules and credit line objectives. And owners generally suffer some credit loss during the course of their business because they're a true believer in their
right.
business.
Why are you such a good bet? Why do the banks bet on you?
$6 billion in awarded contracts, that's why.
Uh-huh.
And so when you have an organization that is financed for the proper amount of time, and if you think you're going to come into the government space and get business in 6 months, which is the traditional commercial model,
right.
if I can hire a guy with good hair and shiny shoes and smiles right, you know, he's going to go out and bring me some business. It doesn't happen like that in the federal government.
Right.
So your procurement cycle is roughly about 15 to 18, 2 years, basically.
So if you've sold $6 billion worth of goods to the federal service, you've made a little bit of money along the way.
Oh, yes.
Why stay in the business? Why stay active?
You know, I love the business. One of the things that I, well, I'll tell you a story. I worked for a tyrant of a boss in Florida, and I didn't like him. Didn't like him at all, but he was brilliant. And I saw where he was going, and I loved the work. And so I eventually grabbed, I've mentioned dismantled Minuteman II missiles, and I thought, well, I'll never be able to do this. You know, this is too technical for me. And I said, if I can do it, I'm going to stay, and if I can't, I'm going to get out, and I'm going to work it hard and go in every. And so what I found is that it really is a people business, and I found out that business development is key. And you know, through the launch control facilities and some of the other things, I found the people that have left Boeing and different areas, and I was able to assemble a winning team, and that told me that I had something to offer. And so,
one of the things you mentioned to us earlier was that you drilled down and learned in your previous experiences exactly how everything in the company worked. You do that with your client companies today?
Yes. We are, of course, we subscribe to Carnegie Mellon, the CMM capability maturity model. So we're a very high-performance organization steeped in our own processes and technology. So, again, the four pillars, people with competency that know the space, processes, we have tried and true processes that win, the technology, we have our own communication platform, and then, of course, the alliance partners. We have over 20 years in this business. I can call Lockheed or any of the Beltway companies, not only call them, but I know what they're capable of doing and where they're doing it.
What were you like as a kid?
I was, you know, I think I was a happy-go-lucky kid. I was always very competitive. So competitive would probably sum me up. Like, I love sports. I love being outdoors. I love traveling. So I was very high energy.
Yeah. It must have been a difficult thing, having been a family business growing up in one, to watch your father have to go ride a business into decline.
It was brutal.
Say more about that. What was it like for you?
Well, you know, your father is your hero,
right?
You know, so to watch them, to watch the man that, you know, is kind of on the pillar of your every learning experience and whatnot, and to watch him night after night come home and be kind of beat down and not be able to solve the problems, because big business, when it moves in, comes with a lot of resource and a lot of capitalization. If you're too late to that dance, the game is really over. And even when I talked to him about selling, he was too proud to, you know, he built that business from the ground up. And, you know, it's just, it's a hard thing to tell somebody. If you experience it, you know what it's like to see, you know, that hero come in every day, you know, just disgusted.
Looking back on it, did you make a key decision or decide something that, you know, I've watched my dad go through this, I'm gonna?
You know, I don't know if it was like that, but I knew what winning was and I knew what losing was. And if you can identify, I mean, at some point you have to self-analyze. You have to step back and look at what it is you're doing. I have had to reinvent myself in this industry three or four times, and a lot of it came by stepping back and self-analyzation.
Right.
When I built ePipeline, it was because as a business developer, I didn't feel I was bringing enough to the party. I wanted to be the smartest one at the table. So I had to go find where were the government databases? How did I get in there and decipher what they had?
Yeah.
How could I bring value?
So you've accomplished quite a lot. What's your proudest moment up till now?
Well, my proudest moment is probably my children. You know, that's a, I mean, that's a life-changing event. I don't know how many can tell you that. So I have two daughters, one at 6 and one at 12, Lily and Livia.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably my proudest moment.
If I was interviewing your father, would he be surprised at your success?
I think so. I think so. I think he already is, you know. So it's one of those things that, and I still consult him, you know. We're pretty good that way. And
what would you say you learned from your mother?
Well, my mother died early on. Died when I was 11.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another tragic event in my life that kind of set me out on my own also. So, I mean, your mother's kind of that nurturing agent, and, you know, father's a little more stern. So at 11, my mother died of cancer. And it was a lot of lonely nights, and, you had to kind of figure things out for yourself. You had to get dressed. You had to go figure out how you're going to eat and all of those things.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to hear that. What's the website address, Chris?
Website is www.govg4i.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Chris Stahl, who's the president of G4i Development Group, Inc. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is...
John Tittle.
John, who are you with?
I'm with Convene.
What is Convene?
Convene is a national organization of CEO peer group, roundtable, CEO roundtable, Christian business leaders who come together to help each other deal with their business issues.
How do they help each other?
In forum days where we get together for a day, we work together around what's really going on, in a trusted, safe environment where you can bring issues that you might not have any other place that you can really talk it through.
When you say safe and trusted, what do you mean?
Well, let me give you an example. One of our members came with an issue that they needed to, their starting place was, I think I need to restructure the positions in my board.
Yeah.
And so we explored that issue. At the end of the discussion, I asked the group, so what's the real issue? Ah, key insight. Where we started was not the real issue. It actually was the people weren't performing, and the group said, you don't need to change the position descriptions. You need to fire those folks and get the people who'll do what you need to do. That, I mean, this is not an issue that this person would have been able to work with her board, right?
Right.
So took that recommendation, worked that through. Huge, huge impact on the organization.
Who's a good candidate for a peer group like this?
Somebody who's in the hot seat. You have to find that balance of strategy, performance, delivery, people, all the rest of it. And you're ready, you're trying to drive things to make things different, and you realize you need some help.
How do we get a hold of you, John?
ConveneNow.com.
ConveneNow.com. We've been speaking with John Tittle of Convene, and that was your Business Spotlight.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. I'm joined by David Taylor, my co-host, who's with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a gentleman by the name of Chris Archer, who's the president of a company called Radius Technology Group. What is the Radius Technology Group, Chris?
Radius Technology Group is a government contractor, and we specialize in three lines of business: IT, security services, and geographic information systems.
How long has the company been in business?
We've been in business for approximately 12 years. We actually got our first contract in June of 2002, but we actually incorporated a year before that.
Uh-huh. And how big or small is the company today?
We have about 45 people.
Why those particular business lines? Why those three?
Right. Well, IT, because my past experience was in the IT arena. So within IT, there's a wide variety of things that you can do. But we specialize in IT security program management, data architecture, system engineering, and infrastructure support. Our security services are, how do we protect this physical space? Not guns and guards, but how do we make sure that the people who have access to your physical location are the ones that are supposed to be there? And then GIS systems, a friend of mine who runs a huge program that does a lot of GIS analysis said, hey, you should look at this as a up-and-coming field. And so we did, and we started putting a lot of resources in. We started working with the University of Maryland, and we do a lot of work in support of them.
What does GIS mean, and what does it do?
Okay, well, GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems. If you think about GIS, your GPS in your car is a GIS system. And what Radius does, we do a lot of analysis of the data that GIS systems collect, particularly in the areas of agriculture. We help our clients determine what types of agricultural crops are going to be grown in a certain area, if the area is suitable for that. And then we lay out maps and we help them plot which areas to, you know, plant corn or, mm-hmm. you know, wheat, if there's going to be a robust wheat crop or something like that. Mm-hmm. So use all those.
That's an interesting field, and I know you got the tip from your friend, but how did you know it was a good idea?
Well, because I knew that just in my practical day-to-day living, you see that everything is mobile now, right? People don't want to have to sit in front of a computer all day to get their information. Your cell phone is more powerful than computers of just 5 years ago. And so as I looked at the marketplace and how things were being mobilized, computing was being mobilized, I tied this GIS stuff to the mobility of systems and computing and applications. And so we made a strategic decision to figure out where our niche could be. We knew that we could secure these systems because we're very good at IT security.
Yeah, where did this ability to see the big picture, where did that start coming from?
I like to say that I'm a big dreamer, and I'm always my head is always in the stars somewhere, you know, dreaming about something big, you know, flying airplanes or, you know.
When did that start? How young were you when you started dreaming big?
Had to be at least 5-6 years old. Uh-huh. I thought I was going to be an aeronautical engineer or, you know, a submarine engineer, and then I found that the math and the formulas were too hard, and I said, forget that. And, you know, and I always saw around my neighborhood a lot of business owners and people who kind of directed things and made stuff happen, and my uncle was a mechanic and all that, so it kind of put all of those things together.
So take us back. Where are you from?
I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Uh-huh. Born and raised.
At a time when Brooklyn isn't quite as fashionable as it is today, I can imagine.
Oh, no. We grew up in the age right when disco, I grew up when disco was real hot. And Brooklyn, New York was a challenging environment, especially where I lived. And, you know, I grew up with a lot of smart people who didn't really make it. And it was a great place if you got out, because it kind of gave you a certain amount of tenacity. and it gave you a good perspective on what was a good life versus what was more challenging, and it helped you appreciate stuff.
But it doesn't. That's not the end of the beginning of the story. You actually come from a family of immigrants.
Yeah, my family is from Trinidad and Tobago. My grandmother was the first of my family to come to America. That was in the mid-60s. And I'm the first American-born child. And she came in with an incredible work ethic. She worked multiple jobs. She worked. She ended up working for my mom at East Hospital as a nurse's assistant for 22 years, and retired, not making more than $22,000-$23,000 a year. And she has houses in Trinidad and New York. So
you got to know your grandmother pretty well, I would imagine.
My grandmother more than my mother was a critical piece of stability, because she was always there at the same time every day. You know, food, dinner was already, you know, and she worked incredibly hard. My mother was very young, so she was still going to school and that kind of thing. So my grandmother and my aunt were very stabilizing forces in my life.
Looking back on it, what do you think you learned from these women, these really hardworking women?
The basics. Take care of the basics. Take care of the basics. The stuff to keep the lights on types of things. Make sure you got a good home. Make sure you pay your rent. Make sure you got food on it. You know, just very basic stuff. You know, every week, say we go to the grocery store, buy groceries for the whole week. Like clockwork. You know, every paycheck, they would put, you know, money away on the side. Very basic.
Yeah.
Kinds of things, practical things.
But there must have been opportunities for you to take a left turn and go the wrong way.
Oh yeah.
Why didn't you?
Because I always felt like I was smarter. Well, I don't know smarter, but I always didn't want to be the one that got in trouble.
You didn't want to disappoint mom and the grandma?
I didn't want to disappoint them. I saw that the road that a lot of people were taking were really like a dead end. You know, they might be the man on the block today, but, you know, a few months later they were in jail. And, you know, all the people that came out of jail really had a tough time living life afterwards. And I knew that wasn't what I wanted. And this is a critical thing that I need to mention. My mother was... She always was in a crowd of people who were, I guess, upwardly mobile. So she took me everywhere that she went. You know, she did a lot of movie editing, and she was in the arts and stuff. And so I saw a different side of living. Plus, my family in Trinidad, they worked pretty well. They had pretty good jobs and lives in Trinidad, some of my family. So I saw, like, a different side to things, and I knew what I didn't want. Didn't know what I wanted to do, but I know what I didn't want.
Where was Dad in the picture?
My dad, he wasn't really in the picture. He last time I saw him, I was around 6 years old. He died when I was about 16, and didn't know he died until I was about 17. So there was like a big, what I like to call a blank.
Right.
And
but you had an interesting way of describing how you came to realize the absence of your father in the green room. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, when I got married and had kids, that's when you start running a business, you start to see, well, something is missing. You know, there's something, the way I'm reacting to these types of situations, the way my perspective is on things, something is missing. That's the best way I looked at it. And my wife her father is pretty involved with her, and I see her brother is very involved with, you know, they got a very strong family. And you start to see, wow, that's kind of what I'm missing. Even though I had uncles, they did not really put a lot of time into me.
Yeah.
So that's where I see.
So because of that, what key decisions have you made to make things different for you?
Well, for me, you know, some people take one route, which is, hey, I'm going to be, you know, they repeat all the same mistakes, right? I made a conscious decision that I wasn't going to be like that. I wasn't going to leave my kids.
Right.
I wasn't going to, you know, be the one to rock the boat or anything like that. And that just served me well, but it's also, you know, put some challenges as well. And so I had to learn, I've learned to better balance that out where I don't have to take care of everybody.
Chris, you mentioned that you were smart enough to avoid getting in trouble because you saw that as the road to nowhere. But you also mentioned in the green room that you learned at some point that you didn't have to be the smartest man in the room. That, for example, you mentioned that the aeronautical engineering or the submarine engineering was a little bit on the heavy mass side. But you learned that your key competence was in managing people. Can you tell us more about that?
Well, you know, what I noticed, again, I guess growing up in New York, is that everyone who was the man on the block, everyone was trying to take them down a notch. And I said, well, that's not the way to go. You know, I don't want that much attention. I also grew up around in New York. There's a lot of people who are very smart. You know, they're hustling and trying to make another dime. So I recognized how to recognize that. And I recognized that while they were real smart, I had a talent of recognizing that they weren't that smart because they were smart. I don't know if that makes sense. You know, usually a lot of people who are super intelligent, I found they think that they can do it all. So I recognized that I couldn't. And through my career, I've seen the most effective managers are the ones who enable people to do their work.
You went to college?
Yeah, I went to Howard University.
Where'd you get what was your degree in?
Marketing.
Marketing.
Yeah.
And then you spent, where were you before you started the company?
I was working for KPMG. They were a big, you know, accounting firm. Mm-hmm. And I got hired to do SAP, which is a big ERP, Enterprise Management System.
So from marketing to that, how'd you get there?
Well, I tell you, I didn't know when I picked marketing as a major, I didn't know it was marketing. I thought it was the stock market. So I like to say that I didn't have a true like design plan of what I wanted to do. So marketing really was a blessing for me because it really marketing is all about understanding people's behaviors, desires, and wants. So I really, really, really kind of keyed into that. So it really served me well.
So at what point did you realize, you know, I've got to go off on my own and start something?
Well, I've always been somewhat of an entrepreneur. I've been working since I was 14. I couldn't wait to get my first job, to get my work permit. So I've always been working. I did a variety of things.
What did you do? First time, what was your first job?
My first job was just doing stock boy clerk. But I've been a bike messenger. I've replaced glass windows in cars. I did some electrical work. I just like making money too.
So what was the toughest thing about starting the business?
You know, for me, quite frankly, I say that I was very lucky because my work, I've worked for a government contractor before. I've project managed, you know, contracts. Then I worked for, you know, Fortune 500, Coca-Cola. I worked for KPMG. And all those things kind of helped me understand a lot of the basics, from consulting to a lot of the back end things.
So you feel you were kind of queued up and ready to go?
Yeah, I was queued up, and plus I wanted it.
Yeah.
You know, I've just always been looking.
Well, let me ask it this way. What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
The toughest thing I've ever accomplished? The toughest thing. The toughest thing I've ever accomplished. I think the toughest thing that I'm working at is being a good father and husband.
That's a full-time job.
I mean, that's you know, and being a good, I know I'm a good employer. I feel real confident about that. But, you know, especially when you're raising kids and trying to be a good spouse, those are the toughest things.
If I was interviewing your grandmother, would she be surprised at your success?
No.
What would she say about you?
Oh, man, what would she say? She always would say, look, what would she say? I don't know, but she always tells me that she never told me. She always.
What would you like to tell her if she was sitting here right now and say, Grandma, here's what I most appreciate about you? What would that be?
For being that source of stability. Yeah. She's the turtle that wins the race. Uh-huh. And that's what I model my business and life after.
Great. What's the website address, Chris?
The website address is www.radius360.net.
We've been speaking with Chris Archer, who's the president of Radius Technology Group. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses. And a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. You know, I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, you know, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz. I'm joined by my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Joining us for this segment is a young lady by the name of Carrie O'Brien, who's the co-founder and CEO of Germain Systems. Welcome, Carrie. What is Germain Systems?
Germain Systems is a company that I and my co-founder started about 15 years ago. It's a company that designs and ruggedization to commercial servers.
For people that aren't familiar with ruggedization, what does that mean?
Basically, we work through shock and vibe and thermal power requirements that are challenging to many operating environments, difficult operating environments.
That's fine. So that means, well, give us an example of what a difficult operating environment is.
A difficult operating environment is one that has too much heat, too much vibration. So customers that would come to us would be like the military. Most of our gear is on the United States submarines.
How? When was the company founded?
1997.
And how big or small is it today?
It is now 70 people, $30 million in revenue.
That's a pretty good size. So you must have a degree in mechanical engineering?
No, I do not.
Do you have a degree?
I do not.
So you started a business in 1997 at $30 million in revenue, and you did it without a college degree?
Yes, I did.
Well, tell us about that. Why start the business in the first place?
We started the business because we knew that we had maxed out in our fields as it was. I was in dentistry, and my partner was in data communications. And we knew that we would either have to go back to school and get a degree to advance our careers, and we had five young kids at the time, and realized that was probably not practical. We had both had a business in previous lives, and so we decided to go ahead and take the chance and try and just work hard.
Wow. What business did you have in a previous life?
I ran a restaurant.
Uh-huh. And your partner?
He had been in...
I think you were telling us some kind of data engineering or something like that.
Well, he was actually in, like, sales and whatnot. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So what a gutsy move to just make this kind of a decision with five children.
Well, we knew that... the worst that could happen is we would lose everything, but we'd at least have our health and our family and our faith and could go forward from there.
So how did you start? Give us kind of an overview of the first year.
The first full year in business, we actually were, we started out as a consulting business, and what we found at the end of the first full year, that it was during the dot-com bubble, and so many people... knew about us and knew that we could design computers and robust and rugged computers. And back at that time, when I mean rugged, they knew that they could get a 486 that could operate like a Xeon, just about, and their hardware wouldn't crash. And so this was a big deal. So we went through and helped small companies, and they wanted to know whether or not we could network their desktops. They wanted to know whether or not we could.
So you guys proved yourself one step of the way, I think, is what I'm hearing, right?
Right.
When did you make the decision that hardware would be the better angle?
At the end of the first full year of business, because when we looked at the revenue numbers, we realized by accident we did probably five times revenue in hardware, and we didn't even think about it. It was very easy.
Yeah.
And we also recognized that was, I felt that was a business line that had legs versus consulting, because training and consulting are the first things cut out of a budget.
So that's an instinct that is actually contrary to the way a lot of companies went. Some companies were abandoning hardware and going services. You chose to go the other way. Tell me about your instincts. How did you know it was a good thing?
Well, I don't know if it was necessarily a good thing. I just felt like we were going to have a lot longer longevity in business, and we were trying to figure out how we were going to last. And I felt in consulting, because times were good back in 97, 98, 99, and I just felt that consulting, while the profit margin was there, not in the hardware business, if we managed our expenses and we lived within our means, then that was going to be the better route, because we would be there around longer.
What surprised you most looking back on it with respect to starting the business?
With respect to starting the business, what surprised me most? I think what has surprised me most is that I've been able to do well in business, because I never expected to go into business. And what I found out, because I thought it was about, you had to have a great idea, you had to have financial smarts, you had to have very good management skills, and what I came to find out is that it's really about relationships, it's about people, and it's about being able to be honest with, can I help you with your challenges, and fulfill the needs that the customers have.
Right, and you're good at that?
I feel like I am, yes.
Yeah. How did you... So tell us, take us back. Where are you from?
I'm an Army brat, so I'm kind of from around the world, but I was born in Fort Ord, California.
Uh-huh. And where did you spend your early years?
The first half of my life I was spent mostly overseas, about 4.5 years in Panama, 3.5 years in Korea.
Tell us about the Panama experience.
The Panama experience, I think, was fascinating, because I was there from 5 to 10 years old, and I think that's a very impressionable age. You're starting to look out and around the world, recognize there's more outside the home.
Right.
The Panama Canal was a big part of our life, because you're there for a reason.
So talk to me as a 5-year-old. I mean, you're 5, 6, 7, watch in this amazing place. What was impressing you about that?
The topography. I mean, we learned about mosquitoes. We had the mosquito trucks come through every night and spray. So, and it got dark at 6 at the same night every day. We would go be outside playing from 7 in the morning till 6 at night, and nobody worried about us. I mean, my mom worried about snakes and everything, but and us losing shoes. I think for the first 6 months, she was buying shoes just about every other day, trying to keep us shooed. and we would go off and play and leave them somewhere, and she gave up eventually. It was just a fascinating place. I think learning about the wildlife, the animals, all the different plant life, and then also in school we learned about the construction of the Panama Canal and understanding, you know, what all the heroic efforts that went through to make that happen. And then my parents would take us down to see how the operations worked. And then also they paid attention to when some big major ship would come through the area, and so we'd go down and watch it. And so just...
Sounded like fun.
It was different. I mean, I can't imagine too many other people who have that experience.
Yeah. After Panama, where'd you go?
We went to Fort Monroe, Virginia. Uh-huh. And we were stationed there, and that was fascinating. The first house that we were in, from my bedroom window, I could see submarines and surface ships and all kinds of boats. Tankers were not interesting. Coming in and out of Norfolk, and I could see the men standing the line, manning the line, and so that was a fascinating sight. The second house that we lived in while we were in Fort Monroe was inside the moat, and we were in Robert E. Lee's quarters, and he's supposed to be an ancestor of mine, although it's not proven. And so that was fascinating to live in history and then walk the Casemate Museum and walk the top of the moat. And so it's just, you know, I've had a lot of beauty and experiences.
You mentioned in the green room that your dad was a key influence on you and that he was a process guy. What do you mean by that?
I think so. Well, he went to school for marketing, so he was always, you know, interested in new ideas and, you know, seeing how things... But he was also very much... He would rebuild engines. He would he'd work on his own cars. He would also... There's a process to it. You take it, you break it down, and then to put it back together, you have to have a process to it. He had four daughters, and so managing the logistics of, you know, four girls and not as many bathrooms and who needs to get where on time, I think had, I recognized what he was doing. And then later on, when I had my children, I was watching an old movie. I think it was based on, like, 12 is Enough or something. And so I saw that this guy was, and it's based on a true story, and I don't remember the name of the movie, but it was about this guy who had, like, 12 kids, and what he had to do, this is the turn of the century, in the 1900s, and what he had to do to get all of his kids fed, clothed, bathed, through whatever system to get through your day.
I think it might have been cheaper by the dozen.
Maybe something like that. But the original version, black and white, is what I saw. And so I thought, oh my gosh, that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. You also spent some time in Korea, I understand.
I did.
Tell us about that a little bit.
Korea was fascinating because we got to learn about different cultures. The food, the people were fabulous. Just seeing a whole different way of life. You could see that the beauty in different cultures. And then I met some of the best people I've ever met in high school there, and we've remained friends till now.
How do you suppose all these experiences contributed to the way you lead your business today?
I guess growing up in the military, you see honor and integrity, you see hard work, you see diligence, you see methodology. I think being exposed to different ways of life, I see that you don't have, there's not just one solution, there are different ways that you can go about to have a better outcome than maybe one that I can think of.
Right.
You mentioned in the green room why not culture. What do you mean by that?
When somebody comes to us with a challenge, you know, a business challenge, we're there to help them solve their challenges. And so we have throughout the years been told you always have a why not attitude. And so we take a look at things, and just because we haven't done it before or somebody else hasn't done it before doesn't mean it can't be done.
So you permit mistakes in your organization?
Yes, I do. So we don't shoot messengers, and you're allowed to make mistakes. I mean, at some point, you have to recognize if somebody's not going to get it or do it right. But you learn by mistakes, I think, more than you do learn from just successes.
You had a great kind of way of summarizing that in the green room about biology and what it taught you.
And
Well, I never, like I said earlier, I never expected to find myself in business. And
right.
what the avenue that I did want to study was biology. And what I found in school was that being a perfectionist, I found that in science, you're not wrong. But what you do if you have a failed experiment is that you just proved it didn't work that way. So you just try another way to make it happen, as long as you're realistic about what needs to happen.
Right. What would you say the toughest thing you've ever accomplished is? Professionally. Starting the business, maybe?
No, that wasn't as hard. I think staying with it and making the right decisions, even when it's you're in your hardest, darkest hours.
Wow. Can you talk a little bit about the darkest hours?
Those are when you have to keep the long-range picture in mind and not give up, when everything tells you, you know, why are you moving forward in your heart and your soul, but
yeah.
you realize you can't give up. And so to find whatever that is to keep going forward.
What is it about you that's this tenacious? Where did that start showing up?
It must be stubbornness. I mean, because I probably say yes to more than I need to say yes to, just because why not? Let's try it.
Yeah.
So sometimes you make mistakes in that.
How about your proudest moment? What would you say that is up till now?
My kids
mm-hmm.
and their accomplishments.
If I was interviewing your father, would he be surprised at your success?
To this degree, probably, but maybe not.
Uh-huh. How about your mom?
I think she might be surprised, yes.
What do you think you got from your mom growing up that contributed to your success today?
Heart.
Heart. Say a little bit more about that. What is heart in your definition?
It's thinking of others. It's caring about your impact on them and making sure that you don't take advantage of those that are less fortunate.
Mm-hmm. What's next for you? How long do you want to be in business?
I don't know the answer to that. Do I want to work as hard as I do always? Not necessarily, but I can't imagine not doing something.
Mm-hmm.
So whether that is in the business or in volunteering or something, you know, down the line, I'd like to be able to give back.
All right. What's the website address, Kerry?
It is www.germaine.com.
Great.
G-E-R-M-A-N-E.
Wonderful. We've been speaking with Kerry O'Brien, the co-founder and CEO of Germaine Systems. I'd like to thank David Taylor, my co-host today from Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me out with the interviews. We've had a terrific lineup of guests today, including Chris Stahl, who's the president of G4i Development Group, Inc., Chris Archer, who's the president of Radius Technology Group, and finally, Kerry O'Brien, who's the co-founder and CEO of Germaine Systems. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
So, guess what I just heard?
You mean about the Roth TSP?
Okay, yeah. Well, also...
that bid protest on the DOD contract.
Right. But did you know...
who the Senate confirmed for the administrator's job?
Well, what about...
OMB's digital strategy.
Jeez, how do you know everything that's going on in the federal government?
I know, because I signed up for Federal News Radio's email alerts.
Be in the know and know it first with Federal News Radio's email alerts. Sign up today at federalnewsradio.com. Search email alerts.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility.